Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Forget location, location, location in the real estate business. Try tax code, tax code, tax code instead. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday, October the 3rd. Good as always to have you along, everybody. If by some twist of business cycle fate, you are going to have a net operating loss of $916 million in a single year. And if, as the New York Times reported this weekend that Donald Trump did, you are going to claim that loss on your personal income tax returns, real estate is a pretty good business to be in. Speaking in Colorado this afternoon, Mr. Trump had this to say indirectly about the Times story.
I have brilliantly used those laws. I have often said on the campaign trail that I have a fiduciary responsibility to pay no more tax than is legally required, like anybody else. Or, put another way, to pay as little tax as legally possible.
First of all, that's not what fiduciary responsibility means, but that's an entirely different story. To the idea of paying as little tax as possible in the real estate business, though, Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going with Mr. Trump and the tax code.
If you are a real estate developer and you buy, say, a $100 million building, tax law allows you to depreciate it. Basically, put down when you file your taxes that it's worth less every year for decades.
Meaning you can take $100 million of losses over that period, even though the building is not actually going down in value.
Theodore Sato is a professor at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles. Now, these losses, these artificial losses, Sato says, lower your overall tax bill if you happen to be in the real estate business.
You can use them to offset income from other sources, including your salary.
So even though your building is going up in value, the law allows you to pretend, magically, that it's going down if you are in the real estate business. But wait, there's more.
When you sell the building, you then are taxed, but at capital gains rates.
Capital gains rates, as in lower rates than your likely income. So for decades, you can shelter your income with losses that don't exist and then pay lower taxes when you sell. That is, if you sell.
The trick in real estate is not to sell if you can possibly avoid it.
Edward Kleinbart is a professor at USC's Gould School of Law.
What real estate professionals do is, rather than paying tax even at the preferential capital gains rate, what they can do is flip one real estate investment into another real estate investment without paying any tax as you go along.
They use special brokers to arrange the sale of the old property and use the profits to purchase the new. Now, you, if you sold your Apple stock and bought Microsoft, you'd have to pay taxes. And one more real estate-related advantage?
You can take cash out to finance your business, your lifestyle, by just going to a bank and borrowing against the collateral.
Both Kleinbart and Sato have an explanation for all these benefits, a very powerful real estate lobby. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Facebook rolled out a new feature today, one with a catchy name, truth be told, Marketplace. Nice, right? We should have hit the gong right there or something. Flattery aside, it's Facebook's second try at tapping into the online classifieds business, which it did try without success back in 2007. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has this update.
Classifieds are a big market. Remember, newspapers used to live off them. Rob Patterson is with Advanced Interactive Media Group, which tracks the classified business globally.
A conservative estimate just in the U.S., the classified industry would be worth more than $19 billion.
And a lot of users, about 450 million of them, were already using Facebook to buy and sell stuff, according to the company. But it wants everyone to use Facebook instead of Craigslist or eBay.
They're basically trying to take over every interaction that could possibly occur on the internet, it seems.
Alexia Clancy runs Capitalize Social, a social media consulting firm. She says Facebook has something other classified sites don't.
I can actually see your real name. I can see who you are. I can see that you have friends. So it makes it easier for me to trust you.
The service doesn't cost anything, at least not yet, but Alabama State University's Thomas Goyee says Facebook doesn't need to charge. The company makes money just by keeping you on the site.
And that can create more opportunities for Facebook to push advertisements as well as gather additional data of users' preference.
And those opportunities to push advertisements and gather more user data translate into more dollars for Facebook. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Today in Business Opportunities, the great outdoors, specifically fishing and hunting in it. Bass Pro Shops is going to buy the outfitting chain Cabela's in a deal worth $5.5 billion. Marketplace's Adam Allington is on that story.
Bass Pro and Cabela's both have enthusiastic followers. The merger would create over 180 locations, each featuring its trademark mix of guns, fishing and camping gear, clothing, and of course, taxidermy. So much taxidermy.
The long-term opportunity is it is a larger retailer. They'll have a little more power over their suppliers.
Andrew Burns is an equity research analyst with D.A. Davidson.
I think this is the natural evolution of the space to fewer, stronger competitors.
The sale was prompted by pressure from an activist investor, Elliott Management, a hedge fund known for pushing companies into buyouts. Cabela's was vulnerable because of flat revenue. It wasn't able to increase high-margin sales of things like clothing and shoes.
They didn't prove to be good merchandisers at the time when the gun sales slowed down in the last 2 or 3 years.
Bill Smead is the CEO of Smead Capital Management. He says one thing Cabela's did very well was banking with its customer loyalty credit cards. As part of the deal, Capital One Financial would take over the credit card business, but Smead says Bass Pro will still see a cut for every new credit card it sells.
By perpetuating the loyalty and credit card program, they'll get hundreds of millions of dollars a year in revenue.
Smead says the combined operations will save money on administration, so there could be some reductions there, but he doesn't expect to see any immediate store closures as a result of this deal. In Washington, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
A quick entry from the world of banking before we move on. The state of Illinois is pulling its business from Wells Fargo a week or so after California did the same thing. Ticker symbol WFC. Wells Fargo Corporation off a hair more than 1%. Today, the major indices down as well. Not quite that much. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Currency of the day today is the British pound, trading down near those 31-year lows it hit against the dollar when the Brexit vote happened in late June. Why did it fall, I hear you asking? Because Prime Minister Theresa May said at the weekend that she is going to start the long and sure-to-be-difficult negotiations to actually get the United Kingdom out of the European Union no later than March of next year, which means the EU will be UK-less by the spring of 2019. May also said, by the way, and this is important, that she is going to play hardball with her soon-to-be former European partners, what is being called a hard Brexit. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has more.
This is Romford in East London, a working-class town that voted overwhelmingly to leave the European Union. 3 months on from the referendum and no buyer's remorse here. The hard Brexit flame burns as bright as ever.
I think we can go it alone. We're strong enough to go it alone. We've done it before, we'll do it again.
Oh, I think we should be out now. We should have stopped all the immigration. And we're still getting half of Poland.
And they're taking the jobs, they're taking your homes.
You don't regret voting for Brexit?
No. No, I don't. Not at all.
We can do without Europe. There's a whole world out there, so we can do without it.
Thank you. I formally declare that conference is now open.
Yesterday, at her annual party conference, Prime Minister Theresa May stressed that she will be severing important ties with the EU, but retaining full tariff-free and unfettered access to the European market.
I want it to give British companies the maximum freedom to trade with and operate in the single market. But let me be clear, we are not leaving the European Union today to give up control of immigration again.
Crowd-pleasing stuff, but the so-called soft Brexiters, who want only a partial departure from the EU, say May's stance is hardly realistic. EU leaders have repeatedly said Britain cannot have full access to the single market without free movement. It must keep its borders wide open to all EU migrants. Sam Bowman of the Free Market Adam Smith Institute.
They're not going to give us a perfect sweetheart deal that would make everybody else want to leave as well.
Some EU leaders have spoken about the need to punish Britain. But how? By erecting trade barriers when Britain has a €60 billion trade deficit with the rest of the EU?
Surely they are not going to punish the UK when they have such a huge trade surplus with Britain.
Well, I don't think it's in their interest to punish us, but I think it also doesn't mean we can just choose carte blanche from the single market what we like and what we don't like.
But that is precisely what hard Brexiters want to do, demand a free trade deal with the EU and not offer anything in return. Former Cabinet Minister John Redwood is hard Brexit incarnate.
You wouldn't be prepared to give any ground at all on free movement.
It's non-negotiable. Britain has decided to be independent. Being independent means controlling your own borders.
And real estate tycoon Richard Tice, who bankrolled one of the Brexit campaign groups, says Britain should walk away if it doesn't get exactly what it wants from its European partners.
No deal is better than a bad deal.
But no deal would be a disaster for Britain, wouldn't it, if it lost its access to the single market?
There is this myth that you have to be a member of the EU in order to trade with it. You don't, and actually, we do better outside the EU than we do inside the EU.
The UK, he says, has more success selling services to the US without a trade deal than it does with the EU as a member of Europe's single market. The Eurosceptics are on a roll. Theresa May seems to be moving in their direction, and financial markets remain fairly buoyant. But there's maybe 2.5 years to go. It's still way too soon to say whether hard or soft is the better Brexit. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
With that Brexit news fresh in your ears, this item, another but different look at the internal divisions in the European Union. There was a referendum in Hungary over the weekend in which 98% of the votes were cast opposing European Union refugee resettlement policies. The EU wants each member state to accept a set number of refugees. Hungarians don't. The vote, as it happens, won't count because there was less than 50% turnout, the minimum under Hungarian law. So in any case, the facts on the ground won't change. The thousands of migrants trying to get into the EU through Hungary remain stuck in refugee camps in Serbia to the south, many of them women and children. The BBC's Nick Thorpe caught up with some of them.
This is the refugee camp in Adashevci. It's right next to the main motorway from Belgrade to Zagreb. The camp is actually on the grounds of a former motel here, right next to the filling station.
Katan is 40, a Yazidi from near Mosul in northern Iraq. She's travelling alone with her 16 and 9-year-old daughters and her 7-year-old son. She escaped the genocide of her people by the so-called Islamic State forces in August 2014. Now they're trying to reach her husband in Germany. They crossed the mountains from Turkey to Bulgaria on foot.
I was ill with asthma and high blood pressure, and my children needed clothes and food to eat, but we had to keep going. Sometimes I helped them to stay alive, sometimes they helped me.
Zahra Husseini is from the Hazara minority in Afghanistan. Her parents fled to Iran before she was born. Her husband left her and their two small children last year to go to Europe with another woman. When his parents tried to take away the children, she was forced to flee too. Now she has a new problem, this time with her fellow migrants. Refugees in Serbia can register on a list provided by the Hungarian authorities. They allow just 30 people a day to enter Hungary, the next country on her long journey to Germany. But two single Afghan men are pretending they're related to her to move themselves up the list as families take priority.
I complained to the camp authorities. I told them the men were lying. The officials said it's too late. The list has been submitted. Then the men beat me. They said they will sell my and my children's numbers on the list to someone else. Now I am very worried what will happen to us.
The lists of names of those hoping to reach Hungary line the walls of the canteen in the camp. The Balkan route was declared closed by the government along it in March this year. The fact is, it's still open, but the suffering of those along it, especially of the women and children, is enormous.
The BBC's Nick Thorpe for us in northern Serbia. Coming up,
these women, they deserve to get paid. And it's not more or less than the men. We just want equal treatment.
The glass ceiling on an artificial turf playing field. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 54 points today, 0.3% on the blue chips, 18,253. The NASDAQ down 11 points, about 0.2%, 5,300. The S&P 500 shaved 7 points, about 0.3%, 2,161. As we mentioned, Bass Pro Shops landed a big one with its deal to buy Cabela's. Springfield, Missouri-based Bass is privately held, but Cabela's reeled in 15% to the upside. We talked about Facebook and its decision to get into the business of social selling. Investors liked that. Facebook bartered up 0.3%. eBay bid down 1% today. Amazon stayed about the same. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.62%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, is here. Manischewitz is opening its factory doors to the public to celebrate, giving regular tours for the first time ever. The 128-year-old company makes matzah and matzo ball soups, noodles, borscht, gefilte fish, all the classics. But it's got a new spin on some of them. Marketplace's Sally Herships went along on the first day of the tour.
I have the keys to the kingdom.
So we are at the Manischewitz factory in Newark, New Jersey, and we are heading to the
sample room.
David Sugarman is CEO of Manischewitz.
Very few people from outside our company have ever been in this room, so this is going to be very exciting for you.
This is where the matzah magic happens, and there's a lot of it here.
Whole wheat matzah, organic spelt matzah, egg and onion matzah, Mediterranean matzah.
Even gluten-free. Inside, there are giant machines, conveyor belts, and ovens. We all have to wear white jackets and hair nets. But some of the workers are Orthodox. They have beards, so they also have to wear beard nets. And not only do we have to follow normal food safety rules, Manischewitz is kosher, which means there are extra requirements.
It's absolutely critical that the matzah has to get into the oven within 18 minutes or it's not kosher.
Why 18 minutes?
It goes back generation after generation, thousands of years. It's all to do with that there's no chance of the matzah rising.
There are 5 mashiach on duty, trained rabbinical observers, to make sure the rules are followed. But it's not enough just to be kosher. Products still have to stand out at the grocery store. Menachem Lubinsky is a kosher marketing consultant.
You can walk into a Whole Foods market, for example, and you'll be surprised how many of them carry kosher symbols.
Coke, Pepsi, even Cheerios. Lubinsky says the market for kosher food is worth more than $12.5 billion. It's not just Jews who buy kosher. Other religious groups do too, like Seventh-day Adventists and Muslims, and consumers who just like the products.
For example, kosher salt, kosher pickles, kosher deli.
Liz Alpern is co-owner of Brooklyn-based Gefilteria, which makes artisanal gefilte fish. She says the majority of Jews in the U.S. are from Eastern Europe, but the traditional foods they ate, like borscht and gefilte fish, have been needing an update.
Jewish cuisine was getting somewhat popular, but it was more Sephardic cuisine and Israeli cuisine.
Not every Jewish food has turned out to be a star, like hummus.
It's everywhere. It's all the time. It's on every sandwich.
Alpern says now there is a big demand for updated classics, raw ingredients people can cook at home, and for restaurants where they can try foods like gefilte fish. Back at the Manischewitz plant, conveyor belts are shooting matzahs into an oven at a rate of about 750 a minute. Not every food can be a hummus, but Manischewitz is trying. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Abby Wambach spent 14 years playing soccer for the U.S. women's national team. She won Olympic gold medals, a World Cup. She is a six-time U.S. Soccer Athlete of the Year. She's got more goals in international competition than any other player, man or woman. And this past December, at the age of 35, she retired. She's got a new memoir out. It's called Forward, the position she played, but also something of a motto. In the book, she talks about her relationship with the game and with herself. Abby, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
There are people who will listen to this interview and say, "What? Why Abby Wambach on Marketplace talking about business economics?" The fact of the matter is, it's all over this book, specifically the idea of gender pay.
Yeah.
And the outrageous discrimination
yeah.
that you all faced in terms of what the men's team and men's players were getting on the order of millions and millions and millions of dollars, and you all not so much. You didn't really take that on, though, until the end of your career.
Yeah. It's actually interesting because when you're at the end of something, you realize you start thinking back and reflecting on all the things that you wish you could have done differently.
Yeah.
And maybe I could have spoke up more. Maybe I could have pushed the envelope a little bit more, not to secure more funds or financial success for myself, but I felt like I could have done more for the future, for the next generation. And that's the fight that my former teammates are in now. You know, our World Cup final was the most watched, the most televised game history of all soccer that's yeah. ever been aired
here. But also like NBA finals it beat. I mean, you know, that whole thing.
Yeah. And so that was always the biggest argument laid against us when we went to the table, the negotiating table right. with U.S. Soccer. You guys just don't bring in the dollars. You don't bring in the money. You don't bring in the corporate sponsorship to be able to justify us paying you guys more. But the thing is that it's no longer like the feel good thing to like invest in women's sports, you know.
Oh, yeah, no.
Now it's actually a smart investment where you have a lot of viewerships watching these games, and so your advertising dollars are actually being spent in an economical way. So the thing that the women want is just to be compensated for it.
The other and this is like a work conditions thing is the idea of you all only playing on artificial turf and the men playing on grass and
yeah.
what turf does to your bodies.
Yeah, and it's a lesser surface. It's more economical for not just U.S. soccer, but for FIFA. You know, FIFA yeah. mandated that we play on the field turf for the World Cup in Canada. But we've taken up enough fight with U.S. soccer that I think that they're making sure that the games that they play on are going to be the very least be surfaces that aren't going to jeopardize the health of the players that are playing on it.
Because not only do the men get to play on grass, even if the men got hurt playing on turf, they have a gazillion dollars to walk away with.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's the bigger issue is people don't think about that. You know, if they looked at what U.S. soccer pays each player, most people on the planet would be like, well, that's a healthy living, right? But, you know, we don't get a 401k.
Right.
Our bodies are the only capacity in which most of us could make our and earn our living. So there's so many different factors that are at play here that these women, they deserve to get paid. And it's not more or less than the men. We just want equal treatment.
There is a sentence at the end of the book, and I'm flipping around trying to find it here. You've decided to retire, and you say this. Well, I'm going to have you read it, actually.
Ooh, this is
the
fun.
Bit starting, I talk about my last World Cup.
I talk about my last World Cup. And the hard, cold realization of knowing my time was almost up, and that the one defining skill of my life had faded and dulled. I talk about summoning the will to lead from the bench, telling younger players to seize their chance, that the future is theirs to define.
It's a little bit about what happens when you realize you don't have it anymore.
Yeah, that's a really hard thing when you're 35 years old, trying to decide whether you're going to retire and if you're going to be any good. Because, you know, my currency was scoring goals for my mm-hmm. whole life. That's what I define myself as. So if I'm taking away the soccer player identity, then what am I? So not being able to have that identity and not being able to know what your future identity is going to be, it makes you feel stuck. And I think that I felt that quite a bit at the end of my career.
So here you are now, officially retired.
Yeah.
Your book tour is wrapping up. What are you?
I think that I've probably emphasized too many labels in my life, whether it be athlete or addict or lesbian or whatever it may be. Now I feel like it would be businesswoman. But what I want to be is just a human. But I have to figure out what the heck I'm doing. I got to figure out what I'm going to be passionate about, what's going to excite me, what's going to be able to pay my mortgage, you know? And that's just all in the trying and learning. And I don't necessarily know if I want to start labeling myself quite yet, and hopefully maybe not ever, because I think human is maybe going to be the best label I have.
It's a book called Forward. It's a memoir called Forward by Abby Wambach. Abby, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's a lot of fun.
This final note on the way out today, there's going to be a big concert out in Indio, California this weekend. The Rolling Stones are going to be there. Paul McCartney, Neil Young, Bob Dylan, average age, old. It's being called the Coachella Festival for Old People, which has been turned into, of course, Oldchella. Here's the kicker. AARP Magazine, formerly known as the American Association of Retired Persons, they're going to have three reporters credentialed to cover the thing. Think about that for a minute. All right, we got to go. The Dow off 54 points today, 0.3%. The NASDAQ down 11 points, 0.2%. The S&P 500, 7 points lower. The Bell, 0.3%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Robert Gurova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.